From the heart of rural France, this is the Keto Woman podcast, brought to you by me. Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. I've been keto now for over 2 years, and it has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again, without the constant gain-loss, guilt-virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs under 20 grams a day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds, and the incidental carbs you find in things like dairy. Moderate protein scaled to your lean body mass, and then fat to satiety. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. I'll be asking my guests each week what their keto looks like to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we can't give you medical advice. It's always best to work with your own doctor because they know you and your medical history, and so have access to the bigger picture. The KetoFest 2019 Kickstarter is nearly upon us, and I can't wait to start planning my trip for July. Keep an eye out at ketofest.com for the launch. I think you all know how much I love KetoFest, but don't just take my word for it. Here are a few people who sent me their thoughts on it too.
Hello, keto friends. My name is Louise from Adelaide, Australia. As a college professor, I've been to many conferences, but KetoFest is different, as it is a festival of food, science, and most importantly, community. Over the 2 days, you immerse yourself as you watch cooking demonstrations and listen to science talks. Local restaurants have low-carb keto food on the menu for you to order, and they don't look at you like you're the odd one out when you ask for the bunless burger and hold the fries, the ribeye with extra butter, or a fathead pizza. Last year, I was privileged to help out the dudes with coordinating over 60 volunteers who became our KetoFest Red Army. They worked tirelessly to make KetoFest warm and welcoming. This year, with a successful Kickstarter, you too will have the opportunity to volunteer and join me in helping to welcome our new friends and old friends to KetoFest 2019. I'll look forward to seeing you in New London, Connecticut, July 20 and 21.
Hi, this is Kim Howerton. You might know me as the Ketonist. KetoFest is an annual event that happens in New London, Connecticut during the lovely month of July. I just love this event. It's run by some of the greatest people, my friends, Carl Franklin, and we got Richard Morris, and then some other amazing people are involved, like Daisy Brackenhall and Louise Reynolds. These are like the best people, and you have to come because one, it's all about keto. Two, it's all about fun and connection. And three, there's a lot of really good food. If those are not enough reasons for you to travel to a picturesque town and enjoy immersing yourself in this amazing community of people who love keto and love people, and also getting a chance to hear some amazing speakers, see some food demos, taste some good things. Did I mention the food? Super fun, and you should be there. Look for KetoFest 2019. I'll look for you there.
Hi, my name is Karen Jones, and I live in Waterford, Connecticut, and I've been lucky enough to go to KetoFest both in 2017 and 2018. I have to tell you, it's a lot of fun. The sense of community is amazing. You get to meet a lot of new people and hear a lot of great keto stories. So if you are trying to decide if you want to come or not, please don't hesitate. Get your ticket and come and see us in New London. It's so much fun. Thanks.
This week, Amber O'Hearn returns to the podcast for a catch-up and to talk about the coming up first ever carnival conference that she has organised. L. Amber O'Hearn, MSc, has been studying and experimenting with ketogenic diets since 1997 and has eaten a plant-free diet since 2009 after discovering its profound effects on her mood and cognition. She has presented at various conferences on the role of ketosis and meat eating in brain development and evolution. Her review on the evolutionary appropriateness and benefit of weaning babies onto a meat-based, high-fat, low-carb diet was included as a testimony defending Professor Tim Noakes in his recent trial. She is a data scientist by profession, with prior publications in mathematics, linguistics, and psychology. It's always fascinating talking to Amber, and I'm really looking forward to seeing her again soon at her conference in Boulder. Thanks also to Becky for giving me some extra questions for Amber. She enjoyed answering them. Welcome back, Amber, to the Keto Women podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me again.
Well, it's been a while. I thought it would be lovely to have a bit of a catch up with you, find out what you've been doing, and also get very excited looking forward to your Carnivory Con that's coming up very shortly.
I am very excited.
It's a sellout, basically, isn't it? It sold out very quickly, very, very popular.
It is. It did. We have a wonderful lineup, and I think it was something whose time had come, and everybody's ready for it.
I think that's the thing. I remember when you very first mentioned it and started talking about doing it. And I think you're right. There are lots of low-carb conferences now, but we really needed a Carnivory Con.
We did.
So well done for getting it organized, because I bet it's no mean feat organizing a conference.
Thank you. Yes, it's been a lot of work and I've had some good help, but it's not something I've ever done before, so I didn't know what was going to be involved and I didn't know how much it was going to sell, so I was just flying blind a little bit. But it, like I said, because it was ready to happen, I think that it made itself happen. It willed itself into being.
Yes, I think there's probably something in that when you've got that groundswell and momentum, it will just happen. But it still needs that person, that magic person to sort it all out. So kudos for that.
Happy to be the vehicle.
Perhaps you could tell us a bit about it. Tell us who's going to be speaking, what sort of topics and things that are going to go on for the day.
Well, I tried to get good representation from various people in the community. So I have people whose stories are really inspiring and compelling, like Michaela Peterson, for example. I have doctors. For example, I have Dr. Sean Baker and I have Dr. Georgia Ead. And they will be talking about various aspects of how the diet works. Oh, and Sophia Clemens from the Paleo Medicina Clinic. And then I have people whose focus is more on anthropology and evolution. So I have George Diggs speaking about plant biology, and I have Mickey Bendor speaking about human anthropology, paleoanthropology. And then I have Peter Ballerstad, who's talking about environmental concerns. I have Nick Mailer, who is a philosopher. I think it's really important to include philosophy when you're talking about anything, because the whole limits of our knowledge and the basis of what we're doing needs to be grounded. He's going to be talking about ethical concerns. And then we have people who are experts on running experiments and interpreting data. So we have Siobhan Huggins and Dave Feldman who will be speaking. I'll be speaking. I hope I haven't left anyone out in that roundup, but really, I wanted to create the conference that I wanted to go to. And so these are the people I thought would have a great depth of knowledge in the carnivore community and need to be heard.
I love that. It's really well thought out. I love the balance that you've brought to it, and really every single approach to the subject is covered. When you're saying you're going to a conference about something, that's absolutely what you want, isn't it? To hear about every side of it.
Yes. We have a unique opportunity because it is the first conference that I really wanted to make sure that there was something really rounded. I've been going to ketogenic conferences for a long time, and every once in a while you'll hear someone with a more carnivorous perspective, but it's not necessarily covering everything. And that is really why I put the conference together, because in the last year or so at the ketogenic conferences that I've gone to, there's been so much obvious interest that many people are asking all the experts about carnivorous diets during the Q&A sessions, and some of them had more experience than others, and it just seemed very natural.
Yes, that's a really good point, actually. We all know that keto, I think, is the top term that's searched on Google at the beginning of this year. There's a rise in popularity, but just so, there's a huge rise, it seems, in the popularity of eating the carnivore way. And lots more people seem to be interested in it. Lots more people seem to be doing carnivore experiments, trying it out. You must have seen that. You must have seen this huge swell of interest in it over the last year or so.
It's been really interesting because I had gotten so used to it being a very fringe idea and frowned upon even in the ketogenic community. So if I happened to mention that I wasn't eating vegetables, for example, in a Facebook group, many people were really quite discouraging and shocked to hear it. And now nobody's really shocked. They might not agree with it, but they know what I'm talking about. And so it's been really interesting to observe the popularity surge in the carnivore diet.
Yes, and I think it's interesting how a lot of people who have been keto for a while, and it's the same thing with how a lot of people start falling into fasting, but I think a lot of people start falling into at least verging towards eating carnivore quite a lot of the time. I can see Siobhan in the background there, and I know she is pretty well carnivore these days, and I certainly have days where I am. I wouldn't describe myself as being that way all the time, but I easily have days when that's all I eat. I'm not, and we'll talk a little bit about this because I think it's an interesting question about what is included in your diet, and some carnivores are a lot stricter, if you like, that's not really the right term, about what they eat, and others let a lot more products in. But I certainly have days where there are certainly no vegetables that pass my lips and I feel absolutely fine for it. So, you know.
Yes, and I think that is a fun way to do it once you know that it feels good to eat that way. If you're not compelled to do it for other reasons, for example, if eating a bit of plants isn't necessarily going to give you some symptom that you're trying to avoid, then you can go in and out of carnivory, and it can be just something you do sometimes, or you can do it when you're wanting to feel a particular way. If you feel your best on carnivore, but you feel pretty good when you eat some plants, then you can return to that when you really want to tune up. Well, you know, Siobhan and I were talking recently about how it can be a bit of a trap. Once you've tried it, you kind of never want to go back for a lot of people, but just knowing that it's there.
Well, that is the point. And we've heard your story before. And I think, like with anything, it's great to do it as an experiment for something like 30 days, whatever it is, just to actually see how you feel.
Right.
Because that's exactly it, isn't it? So many people try it and then it's like, whoa, I feel so good. I don't want to go back. It's not a case of making that decision for any theoretical reason. You try it out. And if you start feeling a lot better, I mean, that's what happened with you, isn't it? You just started feeling so much better. Your problems started going away when you took the plants away. So it makes sense.
Yes. So it can become something that you decide you want to do, or it can just be another tool in your arsenal.
And what would you say? This is something I see cropping up a lot. Everyone seems to always want rules for everything, I think. And people like to tell other people that they're not doing it correctly because they're not following this set of rules. You know, you hear it in keto. Oh, that's not keto because of X, Y, and Z. Well, no, actually what you mean is that's not your keto. It can be mine. It can be hers. It can be
yes,
his.
Yes, yes.
But when it comes to carnivore, are there stricter guidelines? Or, you know, I think one of the biggest debates is whether you let in things like dairy and eggs.
Right. That's an excellent question. And I think it's always going to be fuzzy. The basic definition would, of course, be a completely plant-free diet, and that would exclude spices. It would include my plant vice, which is, or exclude my plant vice, which is coffee. But certain things are more sort of generally held to be tolerated in the community as normal sort of concessions. But then if you're actually eating a pickle every day, are you still carnivore? It's hard to know. But I think for most people, especially when it comes to something that is not actually a plant, like dairy and eggs, or even beef, say. Including it or not including it comes down to a combination of personal preference and personal tolerances. If you include eggs in your diet and it doesn't bother you, there's no reason why that would make you not a carnivore. But this sort of average, typical picture that you might get of a carnivore eating just steak might not be how you do it either, and that also doesn't exclude you. But there are some people who have much stricter ideas about what a carnivore diet should look like, and the clinic that I mentioned, the Paleo Medicina Clinic earlier, they do have a much more restricted form of a carnivorous diet, and that's for medical reasons. They want the diet to be specifically ketogenic, and so they would be eating a much higher fat, lower protein version than you might just come to on your own if you just take what you were eating before and remove the plants from it. And they also exclude dairy because they think that it can lead to more problems. And that certainly is borne out by people. If you talk to different people with different experiences, a lot of people do have trouble with dairy. But for some people, it's not really a problem with their symptoms. So I can talk about my experience, for example. The reason I'm on a carnivore diet is for my mood disorder. I know that dairy products don't interfere with the control of my mood disorder, and I can eat them. But on the other hand, I seem to have a very addictive response to them. If I eat cheese or yogurt, I sometimes have a really hard time stopping that. And so that will affect my weight.
Yes, I think dairy is the one that people struggle most with giving up if they feel they need to. So it comes down to basically what your goals are on one hand, and then also just your personal reaction. There's not this, I'm sure there will always be people who have a rule book, because there just are. And like you say, for certain settings, like a clinic setting, it makes sense that there is a set of rules, a set of guidelines, because you're doing it for a specific reason, and presumably you need the consistency for your treatment plan. But what are your feelings on dairy when it comes to, I suppose, specifically weight loss, because that seems to be the problem that people have. It seems to be something that if people are struggling, so if one of their goals is weight loss and they're experiencing a plateau, one of the most common suggestions is, have you tried giving up dairy? And I guess one of those reasons could be that slightly addictive quality. So you have a tendency to overeat, or like I will tend to pick at it, snack on something. Like if I've got cheese in the fridge, it'd be very easy to go and cut a piece off and have it as a snack during the day. Are there any other reasons that you think that dairy can create problems? I know Georgia E talks about the fact that it has the growth hormones in it, because it is this superfood for growing young mammals, basically getting them to be big and strong as fast as possible. You can see how it has the potential to affect us in the same way.
Yes, that insulinogenic property, I think, is something that we need more experimentation on, because I have read that dairy products have a higher effect on insulin than other sources of protein. But I'm cautious about interpreting those, because the effect on insulin that any given food has depends greatly on what metabolic state you're in. So for example, if you just take protein from beef and you give it to someone who is in not in a ketogenic state, it affects their insulin and their glucagon far more than if they were in a ketogenic state to begin with. So it becomes very complex. But I'm definitely inclined to believe that a food that is designed for an animal who's growing could have more of those capabilities of inducing growth. So there's good reason to hypothesize that particular effect. The other thing that I have heard about dairy, and I haven't looked into much, is that it contains a kind of opioid and therefore may have an addictive response or addictive quality because of the opioids in it. But I don't know a lot about that aspect of it.
Yes, I read some articles about that, and I must admit, I could certainly see the logic in it, because yes, I do find it quite addictive.
There's another thing that has been talked about with dairy in this community, and that's Stephen Gundry has said that for people with ApoE4, they would be more sensitive to dairy. He has put that together with saturated fat, and I don't know that he's actually looked at the difference between saturated fat coming from other animals and saturated fat coming from dairy, but he definitely recommends against dairy for those with ApoE4. My only hesitation about bringing that up is that I think his concern has to do with its effect on cholesterol, and in particular, I think raising LDL, and I'm not particularly persuaded that high LDL would be a problem, but it's a connection that might be worth looking into.
And that's very interesting. I haven't read the report properly, but I did plug my DNA into one of these reports, and my memory is not working very well, so I can't tell you which one it was. But I do vaguely remember down that list something that surprised me quite a lot. And it must have been something to do with that gene, because it said that, and this is just laughable, that I had a certain sensitivity to saturated fat. Saturated fat could cause problems for me, and I might be one of those people that is not suited to a ketogenic diet. And I thought, well, that doesn't seem to be the case, but...
It might actually be the opposite.
So that was an interesting thing. So maybe that ties in with the same. I have been told I should avoid dairy in the past. And I have found from doing an exclusion diet that I'm a little bit reactive to lactose. So I certainly do better if I stay to the zero or very, very low carb forms of dairy. I do a lot better. If I go higher, things like cream and cream cheese, I'm okay, but I get a bit Qatari, basically. That's the level of what happens. So it's something that I can put up with, but it's definitely there. So I definitely have a bit of a sensitivity. And you touched on something there about insulinogenic qualities of dairy. And that's another one of those number one questions that comes up. I don't really worry about how much protein I eat. I don't really think I need to. I've always been metabolically flexible, insulin sensitive. So it's not really something that I concern myself about. But for anyone who feels like they need to keep their protein within fairly strict parameters, if they're thinking of trying carnivore, the first question is, what's going to happen when I eat all that extra protein? Because, of course, you're going to have to eat some extra protein. If you're not eating anything else, your protein intake is going to have to go up because, well, it's not all you're eating, is it? Because you're eating fat as well, but you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And the first thing, obviously, that people start shouting, oh, well, you know, I've heard that protein turns into glucose if I eat too much of it. And so that's automatically going to be a problem when I start eating carnivore. I can't only eat my 50 grams or whatever it is a day. What have you got to say to people who are asking that question?
Well, the funny thing is that a lot of people who go carnivore actually end up finding that their ketosis levels go up and not down. So it's a little bit counterintuitive. Intuitive. One of the reasons I think might be just the plain fact that you've taken some, albeit small, level of carbohydrate and reduced it to nothing. So if you, for example, were eating 20 grams of carbohydrate on your ketogenic diet, and then you dropped all of those 20 grams of carbohydrate, the reason that people are worried about protein turning into sugar is that those amino acids can be used for gluconeogenesis, but only in most animal products, only about half of the amino acids even have the capacity to turn into glucose. So if you were going to think about sort of the maximum hit that you could get if the conditions were right, because I think that it really does depend on the demand of glucose more than just the supply of the raw materials. But if you were just going to take a worst case scenario, you would need probably 40 more grams of protein before you could even make up for those 20 grams of carbohydrate. So that means that your tolerance, your capacity to eat more protein just went up. But there is more to it than just that. The ketogenic stimulus really comes down to the balance of insulin and glucagon that's going on in your bloodstream and your signaling system. And so, as I mentioned before, if you give someone who's not ketogenic a big serving of protein, that's going to have a huge effect on their insulin. It's going to make it go up way, way high, and it's not going to have much of an effect on the glucagon. And so suddenly you're going to be in this situation where the signals for ketogenesis are even lower. There's much less call for ketogenesis. But if you give that same piece of protein to someone who already has this very well-balanced, close to one ratio between insulin and glucagon, it turns out that it actually doesn't perturb that balance. So it has only a small effect on the insulin to glucagon ratio, and you stay ketogenic. So it's true that if you keep eating protein, it will gradually change that ratio, and at a certain point, point it's going to impact your ketogenesis. And if you're coming from a pre-diabetic or a diabetic situation where your basal insulin levels are already a little bit higher, then that balance is going to be tipped earlier. But in general, most people are quite surprised to find that they can eat much more protein than, say, that minimum level that's sometimes advocated for and still stay in ketosis. And that seems to be even more true on a carnivorous diet, and we don't exactly know why. One other thing that could be contributing is that if you don't have enough carnitine, carnitine is involved in bringing fatty acids into the cell for burning. If you don't have enough carnitine, then your ability to burn fat can be lowered. And so if you're suddenly eating a lot of red meat, your carnitine levels are going to be completely sufficient, and you may have actually more ability to burn fat and therefore produce ketones. So all of those things combined seem to, at least observationally, result in actually higher ketosis on carnivore, which is very surprising.
Well, certainly as an N equals one, I can vouch for that. What is most guaranteed to bring my ketones up and my blood glucose down? And I operate very well in, Annette Bosworth talks very much about the ratio of ketones to glucose. And I certainly operate best within a certain ratio. And it's that GKI ratio of sort of 1 to 2 is where I do best. So actually, you know, fairly strict. But it's down in that ratio that I get fewer migraines and my mood is better. And certainly if I want to be losing weight, which is not my main priority, but yeah, there's a bit I'd happily lose. That's also where I need to be to do that. But the most important thing for me is the mood and migraines. And if I get up into that zone where a lot of people are quite happy, you know, they're in ketosis and they're doing very well and they're losing weight, whatever it is for them, for their context, no, I need to be a bit further down. But to get down there, it's just reducing those carbs right down. That's what gets me there. And yes, as a balance, I probably do eat more protein. But yes, just as you were saying, that's certainly true for me. All it does is put my ketones up, certainly not down.
Interesting, isn't it?
It really is. Yes. And I think that's what it comes down to. I like experimentation. I encourage everyone else to just try different things and not be doing it so much for numbers on the page, just be doing it to see how you feel. And when you start feeling good, that's what you want to carry on doing, isn't it?
Yes. We have all these studies. In carnivore, we don't really have very many studies, but you look at a study and the main purpose of a study really is to give you an idea of what might work for you, because we know that individuals, even within that study, are going to vary in their response. And what the study is trying to tell you is this worth pursuing based on how much of a difficulty or a cost or a risk it would be to try this intervention versus how well it's going to pay off. And so if you've done something yourself and you already know, then that obviates the need for looking at a study at all, because you've already hit the whole purpose of looking at a study, which is what's going to happen to you.
That's right. That's what it's all about. It's your own context, your own experience, and your own goals. I know you've got Siobhan sitting there behind you at the moment, and she, I don't know if she's changed her favourite meal, but it always used to be pork of some description and cream cheese. So she certainly likes to mix it up. What about the rest of your household? Do they eat the same way as you or slightly differently?
Not exactly. My children, mostly, at least at home, they eat low carb. They will eat vegetables and they like a little bit more variety than I would give them if I were just giving them exactly what I had. So sometimes I will make for them meals such as a chicken coconut curry is one of their favorites, which has coconut milk and it has onions and spices as well as some chicken. They like stir fries and they really like bell peppers. One of my son's favorite meals is salmon with carrots and onions. So that's not even necessarily super low carb. But I would definitely have to say that everybody here eats quite a lot of meat and nobody's deficient in that way.
Do you get any interesting interactions with the school? I know I've had some members in my Facebook group have had some real troubles with the school, you know, disagreeing with the way they feed the kids and having some tussles with the school insisting on giving them certain foods or, you know, even complaining to the parents about the way the parents are feeding their own children. Have you ever had any kind of interactions like that?
I have, unfortunately. Well, one problem is that the schools, I think they're dealing with a lot of blood sugar roller coasters. And so it's become, it wasn't this way at all when I was a child, but there's just available sugar all the time, not just in the cafeteria, but also the teachers and staff will routinely have events or reasons that they find to have what they consider to be healthy carbs often. So muffins maybe, or granola bars, or fruit. And that's constantly on offer. So I have one child who, in middle school, he most of the time was actually aiming to be on a low-carb diet because he knew it felt best. But he really struggled with the temptation, let alone talking about feeling left out socially, but just having that being offered and offered in a way, I think, that the teachers kind of implicitly disapproved of the desire on his part not to eat carbohydrates because they knew about it. Then the other problem is if he ever, for any reason, went to the nurse's office, they would immediately say, look, you haven't had any food. So they would offer, again, like maybe a healthy granola bar. And this child in particular really didn't like eating at school. He didn't even like taking a lunch. So he would have a protein and fat heavy breakfast. And that would carry him through the whole day until he got home after school. And then he'd eat again. And he wasn't hungry. But the teachers knew that he hadn't eaten and would think that this was a huge problem. And so it was always a frustration. Now that he's in high school, he has a lot more independence in that way. And so it's not as much of a deal.
That's really tricky, isn't it? And I certainly understand the temptation side of it. And of course, once you've given into it, it's then even more difficult to avoid. It's so commendable that, you know, he's come to his own decision on that. And it's his own motivation to have that potentially undone by teachers. And this whole snacking culture, I can remember when I was at school, it was just starting to come in. You know, we were just starting to be encouraged to bring a snack of some kind for the breaks. But kids just, they don't need it, do they? Even the tiny ones, they don't need to be eating every hour. You know, you don't have to be carrying snacks around all the time. They're not going to pass out if they have to go a reasonable time between meals. That is what we're designed to do.
Right. Yeah, it's very frustrating.
But yes, I can totally see that. The teacher's freaking out at the thought of him not eating at all at school during the day. It's probably a very good idea because quite often the things that are on offer are just not going to be the best choice.
Yes, exactly.
Well, it sounds like he's through that struggle a bit, but yes, interesting question. And this pushing whatever the agenda and propaganda is on that subject, what do you make of all this latest hoo-ha around the Lancet spreading vegan propaganda, allegedly?
Oh, gosh, Daisy. I find it very sad because, well, I know that one of the people who's behind the funding of that project actually has a connective tissue disease, an autoimmune disease that's considered incurable and that might actually benefit from a carnivore diet. But besides that terrible irony, we have data from countries who live on a grain-based diet with greatly reduced meat intake. Those are the third world poverty countries of today, and they have severe malnutrition problems that could be solved by adding more meat into their diet and also by reducing grains, because a lot of the nutrient deficiencies that are induced are actually induced by the phytates and the fiber in the diet that they are forced to eat out of poverty. And to think that the wealthy countries around the world who have access, have the ability not to eat that way, are now considering trying to eat that way for health is just awe-inspiringly stupid. I mean, have we learned nothing? I find it almost unfathomable that this is what we are now advocating for people for health.
And it's more with the, you mentioned the problems with the grains. They can actually, even if that person who's suffering from malnourishment is eating some good forms of protein and vegetables, it can be negated, can't it, by those grains. So it's not only you're having problems with eating those things in the first place, but you're actually taking away some of the benefits of the small amounts of the good things that you are eating.
Yes, absolutely. I was looking through a document on fortification that was put out by the WHO and the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, and they were talking about the most common global deficiencies that we need to address, perhaps through fortification, and they characterized diets that would induce certain deficiencies. They would have a little paragraph of what's the diet that gives the highest risk for example, zinc deficiency or B vitamin deficiencies or other deficiencies, vitamin A deficiencies, all of these things that are causing huge problems. And in every case, in their paragraph, it would say a diet that's insufficient in animal-sourced foods and a diet that's high in phytates and grains and fibers and that gets most of their protein from soy. We know this. So it's really quite ironic and head-smacking.
Well, and that you need to fortify to balance it out and fortify just the things that are draining it in the first place. It's like you say, it's all just, what are you doing? You touched on that with the link and the association between poverty and what you're eating. And that is something, again, that's brought up with not only keto, but carnivore too, is the cost, that it's something that is going to be a very costly way of eating. What's your experience with that?
If you're comparing to grains, it is going to cost more. It's going to cost more at the shopping counter cashier, but it's not going to cost more at your health level. That's certainly true. But if you're talking about comparing it to getting all your calories and your nutrients from fruits and vegetables, then it's actually not comparatively expensive. It turns out that fruits and vegetables per calorie, they're mostly water. So they're very, very expensive. If you go to the store and you're buying green peppers and kale or spinach and tomatoes and all of these things, it turns out to be very expensive to live off that kind of food. Another component that can be expensive with fruits and vegetables is that there's a high level of waste. Siobhan and I were talking about this earlier, and she asked me, how much meat goes to waste in your fridge? And the answer is almost none. Whereas it was a constant battle when I was low carb, trying to make sure I ate all the vegetables according to plan so that they didn't wilt and go bad in the fridge, especially salads. So there's that as a cost as well. But then meat, you can really, if you want to buy only grass-fed ribeyes, you're going to spend a lot more money than if you're willing to buy more conventional, if you're willing to do some pork, you're willing to do some ground beef, you're willing to buy cuts that are cheaper. And actually, high-fat cuts are often cheaper, which is a great...
bonus.
Yes, bonus, exactly. That's the word I was searching for.
They're the ones that end up in the reduce bin. The only time I buy ribeye or entrecote, as it's called here, is when it's in the reduce bin because it is a bit expensive. But the ones that end up there are the ones with lots of fat in. So it's like, yes, perfect for me. Thank you very much for leaving those behind.
Exactly. So I think it's not as expensive as you might imagine if you were just thinking about eating all ribeye all the time.
No, certainly in my experience, I think if you're a bit canny with it, like you say, and I'm actually doing a budget experiment at the moment, just seeing just how low I can go and eat the way I want to. And it's been interesting seeing what I've been taking a picture of my weekly shop. So I've been trying to do the whole weekly shop in one go so I can have that picture of everything I've bought. And it's shrinking every week as it drops down. I'm dropping down in increments of $5 every week.
Wow.
And it's really interesting seeing what gets taken away. So that first week, you know, I think that, you know, there was a steak and there was some duck and there were lots of choices and there were vegetables and cheese and all sorts of things. You know, I could eat quite a lot on my starting budget of, I think, $40, I think. And then every week it's gone down and it's been interesting seeing what I've taken away. I'm desperately holding on to my bacon with my eggs every morning until it gets, I think this week might see a reduction at least. But it's been, yes, interesting seeing what I'm prepared to lose and what, even though it might be a little more expensive, like the bacon, I'm holding on to. And yes, the things that are being sacrificed first do tend to be the vegetables.
Yes. Two things stood out to me when you were talking about that. One is eggs. I forgot to mention eggs. They're actually very economical. And the other thing is when you're talking about what things you're willing to give up, there's a principle in economics of a good being an inferior good is one that you will only buy a lot of if you're poor. And cabbage is the canonical inferior good. And I think cabbage was, it's one of the longtime vegetables that we've had for a while. We get this impression, I think, that with this five a day idea that back 100 or 200 years ago, that people are eating a lot more and a larger variety of vegetables. But that's really not the case at all. We were eating meat and grains and maybe a little bit of vegetable, and that vegetable would have been potato and cabbage. And so if cabbage is the canonical inferior good, that really stands in for all vegetables. And I think that's very interesting. We only buy it if we have to because we can't afford good quality food.
Yes, that's certainly something that lasted a very long time. Yes, you know, sometimes it's nice to have a bit of cabbage, but yeah, that sort of runs out fast. But it's interesting what you were saying about the waste with food. And even like you say, there's using up the vegetables that tend to wilt in the fridge if you're not careful, where that never happens with meat. But even if that's not the case, even if you're using them when they're fresh, there are bits of it that you throw away that you don't use. Some people might collect those up to make some stock or something, I guess. I mean, mine goes on the compost heap. It's not thrown in the bin, so to speak. But meat, every part of that gets eaten. Because if it doesn't get eaten by me, it goes into a bone bag. You know, it doesn't get thrown away. It goes in the bag until I've got a nice big bag. And then I boil it up and I make stock and I boil it down for a couple of hours in the pressure cooker so that the bones are soft and I have the stock. The dogs get the bones and there's no waste. Zero. None of that meat goes in the bin at all. Ever.
Yes, that's an excellent point.
So it's much better value for money, gram for gram. But also with the budget experiment, I can happily have a couple of chicken thighs with some mayonnaise for dinner and without any vegetables. And then that's enough. When I'm taking more and more back down to the bare bones of what I can buy, if it's only meat on the plate, then yeah, that's okay. I'd rather that than just some vegetables on the plate. And interestingly enough, vegetables are actually quite expensive in France.
They're expensive everywhere, I think. You know, they're not in season very long, so they have to be specially gardened or brought in from somewhere else. Then you have the transportation cost, and many of them do go bad, and so they have to bring them very quickly. I think it's a false economy.
That's something that I want to get back into, actually, is growing a few more things myself, because that is the perfect way to do it, because there isn't much waste there. You can literally go and pick out what you want for your dinner, bring it in and cook it. And that's when vegetables are truly delicious, I think. For me, you know, I don't have the kind of reactions you have to plant material, but that's when they taste so good. You know, spinach that is picked fresh out the garden is just a world apart. It's like fresh eggs, isn't it? Eggs from your own chickens that have been grubbing about for worms and things taste so much better than even the best supermarket eggs.
I couldn't agree more.
You have chickens, don't you?
I don't, no. Maybe one day.
I used to. The fox got them all, unfortunately.
Oh.
There was a discussion I wanted to have with you. It was a question that came up on the forum, and I brought it up in one of our Slack chats, and you weighed in on it, and I found it really interesting. And to start with, this is one of the areas that I like it when I have conversations with people that start changing my way of thinking. I think the original topic that was brought up, or at least the comment that was made, was that you can drink too much water and you can flush electrolytes out of your system. And I certainly knew this was a possibility. I mean, we hear about extreme examples of that with marathon runners, you know, dropping down and having heart attacks, or even worse, dying from losing too many electrolytes. And I can imagine there is certainly a possibility of drinking too much water, but I picture that as a huge amount. But the person on the forum, at least, was saying that it was a much lower amount than I had in my head. And I thought this was rubbish. And I mentioned it in the channel. And then you started saying, well, actually, there's something to it. And I very much respect your opinion and knowledge on things. And I really wanted to have that discussion here and share it with the listeners. So it'd be great if you could talk about that.
Well, thank you. Yes, I don't know all the answers about this, but I have been thinking and speculating about it for a while. I first noticed the water idea when I was talking with Charles Washington, who was the original Forum for Zero Carb Diet owners back in the day, a decade ago. So he's a runner. He runs marathons. And he would mention that he doesn't drink while running and that he doesn't need to. And I thought that was very interesting, but I'm not a runner myself, and so I didn't think about it very much again. But I did notice that one thing that seems to be common among a lot of carnivores is that they give up eating salt. And that seems unusual because in the ketogenic community, at least in the last couple of years, there's been a big push to eat a lot of salt and that this would be good for you. And at one point, I thought, I wonder if that's only the athletes who might be sweating out more salt. So I did I didn't do a poll on Twitter, but I did ask around on Twitter, and I found out that most of the carnivores that I talked to were not eating salt, and that they found that they felt better not eating salt, which was in contrast to the people on keto. And the few exceptions that I found weren't all athletes, so I found some athletes who swore by salt, but some of the people who swore by salt weren't athletes, even within carnivores I'm talking about, and the opposite. So there were some athletes that didn't use it at all. So I had that sort of mulling around in my brain. And then one day I started reading about dry fasting. When I first heard about dry fasting, I thought, oh, that's just over the edge. Like, taking away food is one thing, but your body needs water, right? So why should we ever stop drinking water? But I started looking into it, and I found out that it is possible that your body might want to burn more fat if you are not drinking water. And the reason is that your fat in its storage form is about half water. And every time you burn fat, you get about as much, slightly more water than you get energy, or you get fat out of your adipose tissue. And so I saw an experiment, for example, where they had these finches that they were testing fast, like a food-free diet that had water versus a food-free diet without water. The reason that they're interested in that is because migratory birds, they have a kind of cyclic ketogenic metabolism where they will get really fat and then use that fat to fuel them through their long flights where they can't stop and eat. And they don't stop and drink either, it turns out, very much. And it turns out that the amount of fat that these finches were burning, if you gave them a fast without water compared to with water, was more than three times as much. And so that really made me think, I thought, wow, so if you're fasting and you're drinking water, that could actually be detrimental in the sense that your body won't be calling for as much fat because some of that call might be for water. So how to tie that all together. I started thinking about salt and the fact that the more water you drink, the more salt you need because it can dilute the level of electrolytes. And I was wondering if these recommendations for eating more salt are actually a consequence of our habit of drinking a lot of water. And so my current hypothesis, a pet theory, I guess you might call it, is that on a ketogenic diet, maybe, your need for salt is just less, but when we drink a lot of water, that artificially inflates our need for salt. And so that's the theory. Did that make any sense?
Yeah. What about the arguments? I thought one of the arguments for the fact that you needed these electrolytes, especially when shifting from a high-carb diet into a ketogenic way of eating, is that your kidney's flushing a lot out and you need to replace some of it. Is there a difference between transitioning and then when you settle in, or is that perhaps not the case in the first place? I mean, it's just become such a common thing to see. Electrolytes are a necessity. You can't do without them. You have to, if you're going to start keto, you have to be on your game with electrolytes. I'm just wondering, and I would say for the most part, I don't take them. And I certainly haven't been into any kind of routine. And I did actually try for a while, you know, measuring out a certain amount of salt every day and taking that during the day. And I have to confess, I didn't see any real benefits. And that's, you know, that's only an N equals one. So I don't seem to stop functioning without them, but I certainly do drink too much. That's definitely a thing. And I'm going off on a bit of a tangent here to go back to that original about the whole reason that people use for needing electrolytes, but salt in particular when you're transitioning from high carb to ketogenic?
Right. Well, the transition period might be a case where you could make a stronger case for making sure that you don't lose those, because there is that initial period where your kidneys are trying to figure out what's going on, basically, and you're losing a lot of water, and you will lose electrolytes, and we do need electrolytes. But your excellent question was, what about after that has settled down? So Finney, who I think is extremely smart and always or usually way ahead of the game in terms of thinking about these things, has argued for eating a lot of salt on a ketogenic diet. He recommends, I think, 5 to 8 grams of sodium a day, which is a lot. And he argues that if you don't have enough salt, then your body's going to call for aldosterone, which is a hormone that helps keep sodium and potassium in balance. The aldosterone says keep more sodium, basically, but it also says excrete some potassium. And it's all about balancing the water levels in the electrolyte levels, which are really very important. And I think that's compelling. But on the other hand, you know, I don't know if you know about this, but in the early days with treating children for epilepsy with a ketogenic diet, one of the things that they used to do routinely was restrict water. And I had the assumption that the reason that they restricted water was to concentrate the ketones. And I think that was a naive assumption. The reason now, when I looked into it a little further, is that you have this risk for low salt hyponatremia. And if you have low salt, that can actually trigger seizures. And so dehydration is actually used as a therapy to increase salt levels. And so if you think about it, drinking less water could potentially have the same effect that Finney is arguing for in just raising the relative salt levels. So it's quite possible that his theory and my theory are not at all at odds, because we're both talking about raising the concentration of salt in the blood, but he's doing it by adding extra salt and I'm doing it by adding less water. So it could well be that it's not so much that we need less salt, it's that we just need to keep that concentration and the ratios of sodium and potassium, for example, in the right ballpark. If you look at literature on the Paleolithic, there is this idea, I think Eaton argued about it, where he said that the levels of salt we were eating in Paleolithic days was much, much less than after agriculture. And that this whole, we have a strong history in, once we're in the historical period, of chasing after salt. Whereas in the wild, in other animals, it's usually only herbivores that are going are looking after salt, and carnivores don't do that at all. If you look at the ratios in meat, they're almost what would be considered ideal. The sodium and potassium is this just there naturally. So that also kind of contributes to my idea that once we went on a higher carb diet, that's when salt started becoming super important. So I guess the bottom line is, electrolytes are definitely really important, but how we go about balancing them comes from a variety of things interacting, including our intakes of potassium. I actually heard this morning on Twitter, somebody had mentioned that they take potassium on a carnivore diet because if they don't, they get a lot of muscle cramping. And they came back to me today and said, by the way, after this conversation, I stopped all of my extra intake of salt, and I no longer need to take potassium to deal with those cramps.
It's interesting, isn't it? And I do think that balance is key. And by stripping everything away and focusing on just getting it from the right balance of food, if you can get the food right and the right balance for you, then you should be getting all the micronutrients and the minerals that you need in the right amounts. I know I'm always very leery of supplementing because of potentially throwing that balance out. And again, it's N equals one only, but I used to have really bad restless legs at night and occasional cramps, and magnesium was what I thought to take for that. And it worked, you know, I took magnesium tablet at night and it really helped until it stopped helping so much. And so I started taking 2, and then it just became, well, I'm taking these all the time and it's costing a fair amount of money. And I think maybe what happened, they just ran out at one point and I didn't have any stock, you know, and I just didn't take them for a while. And funnily enough, it was certainly no worse. And then it sort of balanced out. And I hardly ever take magnesium at all anymore. I'll sometimes take a tablet. If I do get twitchy legs or a bit crampy, I'll take one. But I don't tend to. I do fairly regularly have Epsom salts baths. So I suppose I am getting a little bit that way. But I do sometimes think, just stop all the supplements and see what happens and see what you actually need. I think you can get into slightly sort of addictive cycles with supplements and thinking, well, that sounds good. That sounds like it would help me. And before you know it, you've got this great array of supplements that you take every morning.
Yes, and that's a really good point. People often say to me, well, shouldn't you just take supplements as a kind of insurance? But the assumption behind that is that it's free and there's no risk associated with it. And that's not really precisely true, especially when we're talking about the kind of nutrients that are imbalanced. So like you described, you could start taking potassium and then you find that you need more sodium. And so you add sodium to deal with the consequences of that. And, you know, you can build on each other in the way that we sometimes make fun of drugs and adding on drugs to deal with the side effect until you've got this whole cascade of things happening. And it's certainly possible with supplements as well.
But what about water? What about dehydration? I've always been somebody who's drunk a lot, actually, right back as a kid. I only tended to drink water. I wasn't a fan of juice or anything like that. I just drank water. I did like Ribena, but I was only allowed that as a treat. But basically, I drank water. When I got a bit older, I started drinking coffee and I drink a lot of mint tea now. But I do drink a lot and I think potentially I drink too much. And I have noticed after starting to be a little bit more aware of how much liquid I do intake and after you saying that could be a problem. And I'm not sure if it's something we discussed or if it was something that was discussed on the forum. I can be drinking and feeling the drinking is making me feel thirstier. That doesn't sound like it makes any sense at all. But is that some kind of indication that, you know, you're right, I'm drinking too much?
Yes. So drinking can make you thirstier if the electrolytes aren't right in it. Like if you're drinking completely purified water that doesn't have any electrolytes in it, then that can actually make you thirstier. But another thing I've found related to that is that I drink just out of habit to do something with my hands.
Oh, me too.
Kind of maybe like smoking.
Yeah.
I am a former smoker.
So am I.
And I can remember feeling like I just wanted to be doing something with my mouth and my hands and drinking my coffee or even water can sometimes, I think, be not really driven by thirst, but just something to do. So I don't know, Daisy, it might be worth just experimenting with not drinking as much and seeing whenever you have that urge to drink, noticing, why did I just want to drink right now? Am I thirsty? And just see what happens. Could learn something.
Yeah, it's a very good point. It's another one of those things that you see everywhere about how so many people need to be mindful and aware of making sure they drink enough. And you have this whole 8 glasses of water a day and these various things that are thrown about. But yes, I feel like I need to be the opposite, be mindful actually of the fact that I might be drinking too much and actively reduce it. Like you say, all you can do is experiment. But the thought of when you mentioned the guy who runs marathons without drinking anything, well, I can't even run when I did the couch to 5K. The thought of doing that without taking water with me just seems crazy. Running a whole marathon, I mean,
doesn't it?
Yikes. But that sounds like somebody who has maybe got this balance right. Their electrolytes and their water intake is perfectly balanced. So maybe, yes, it's an indication of being thirsty all the time, that actually what that is an indication of, you're flushing too many things out. Stop drinking so much. I should experiment with it.
Well, it's an idea anyway.
So give us a little bit of a tease. What's your talk going to be about at the conference?
Thanks for asking. I'm going to talk about micronutrients and the RDA. I think my talk title is Rethinking RDAs. So I'm going to talk about how the RDAs as a measure of what we need has been routinely misapplied and what consequences that has had. And then I'm also going to talk about how the carnivore diet in particular particular, and in some ways because of its ketogenic aspect, in some ways because of its plant-free aspects, may have actually pretty profound changes in what is required. Since I certainly don't have experiments that can tell you exactly what the new requirement might be in a particular nutrient, but I have hopefully a lot of thought-provoking, question-provoking material that'll make us think about the way that we've been thinking about micronutrients and how we might change that according to this new pioneering kind of diet we're doing.
Fascinating, because that is one of the top things that's thrown up as an argument against it, isn't it? What about all the micronutrients that you're not getting from all those wonderful fresh fruit and veggies that you should be eating?
Well, one funny thing about that is I think that the micronutrient profile of vegetables is sort of the redeeming feature, that they don't provide much else. And so if you want to sell more vegetables or sell people on the idea of eating them, then you say, well, they've got all these vitamins and minerals. But that has given us the impression over the years that that's a contrast to animal-sourced foods. But that's not at all the case. Animal-sourced foods are very rich and usually richer in micronutrients, but now they've got this reputation as being for protein when they're really so much more than that. And vegetables really aren't much more than that one selling point.
And when it comes to the question of micronutrients and bioavailability of them in meat and protein foods, is there a good reliable resource to find out about that if you're wanting to research what's in the food you're eating? Or is it so variable depending on what you're eating and where you live and all sorts of other factors?
Well, the bioavailability itself does actually sometimes depend on your nutritional status. So for example, if you look at vitamin A, in the plant form of vitamin A is actually a precursor. It's not the kind that we need. It's the carotenoids. And the conversion from that to retinol, which is the kind that we actually use, is actually, it varies a lot in people, for one thing. So some people have much less ability to convert carotenoids into vitamin A, and that can be a problem. But it's also the case that the more deficient you are, the more your body will be willing to make those conversions. So if you already have enough vitamin A, you're basically going to get almost nothing from, say, a carrot. But if you have very little, your body will say, okay, we're going to prioritize this conversion. But the kind of flip side of that is that when you're getting it from a plant-based food, your body doesn't make more than it needs, so you don't get extra for storage. Whereas if you get vitamin A from an egg or from liver, you're going to store it in your liver, and then that can carry you over for a longer period. I didn't really answer your question, what resources. I highly recommend looking into Georgia Eads' website if a reader isn't aware of her work, because she goes into the plant versus animal nutrient question very deeply. And so I highly recommend that.
Well, it's fascinating that you happen to jump on vitamin A, actually. Two things. It's vitamin A. Isn't it the reason that women who are pregnant are advised to avoid things like liver? Isn't that because they can end up storing too much vitamin A, which can potentially be a problem?
Yes, it can actually cause mutations if you have too much vitamin A when you're in gestation. And in fact, there was a paper I read, I'm not remembering what year it was from. It might have been about 20 years ago. Might have been a little bit older than that. But there was a committee that was arguing to actually lower the RDA of vitamin A and vitamin C. And the board wouldn't incorporate these changes, even though part of the reason for listing the lower RDA for vitamin A was, in fact, for risk during pregnancy. The reason that it didn't go through, they said was that they thought it would confuse the American public if they reduced these RDAs, which is really quite extraordinary and created a lot of controversy and upset within the community of the people who are working on that.
I did have actually had a deficiency in vitamin A for quite a time. I don't know how long, because it was discovered when it was tested, but of course I have no idea how long I was deficient before it was tested. And they tried to bump it up by giving me very high dose suspended in oil, which I took orally, and that had no effect whatsoever. In fact, my levels carried on going down. They ended up injecting it, the levels still carried on going down. And I've never known exactly what the cause was. I theorized it might have something to do with the weight loss surgery. I also theorized it might have something to do with, and that was my pet theory, that it had something to do with the fact that my gallbladder was removed. Because the way I got my levels up was that I took dry form vitamin A tablets. So when it was suspended in oil, it wouldn't work, however I took it, orally or injected. It wouldn't boost my levels. But when I took the dry form tablets, I got my levels up. But since they went up, I don't carry on supplementing. And I don't know whether that's just a thing. Once you get your vitamin A up to the levels it needs to be, it holds at that level. Or whether, see, you conflate things, don't you, by doing too many things at once. But obviously starting to eat low carb and then ketogenically, I wonder if my diet is making the vitamin A that I'm consuming much more available because I'm eating the proper foods. You know, I used to eat a much higher carb diet with less of that good stuff and, you know, all sorts of junk food and all sorts of things. Whereas now perhaps I'm eating the perfect diet. So I don't know which one of those factors altered it the most, but it just interested me because it was vitamin A that you used as an example.
That is interesting. And it's really counterintuitive that you had to remove the fat because
exactly.
What we know, one of the things we know about
fat
vitamin
soluble.
A is it's fat soluble.
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, I do have the deep suspicion that vitamin A status might be better maintained just because of something about the ketogenic state itself. And that's one of the ones I hope to have more information by the time the conference comes around. But that's one of the ones that's been harder for me to find information on that might be producing this effect. But I have a few things and I won't give them away quite yet why there may be reason to believe that vitamin A status is better maintained even without more intake.
Oh, interesting.
We'll see.
I can't wait to find out. Well, for anyone who's listening who is desperate to come, there's a very small chance, isn't there, that there might be some more tickets available at some point.
Yes, I'm very excited at all the interest that's been generated, and I want as many people to be able to come as possible. And because there are so many people on the wait list, I've decided to look into the possibility of expansion. I can't make any promises yet, but I'm very hopeful that we'll be able to admit more people.
That's fantastic. And you're also looking into the potential of live streaming, but again, there's a big question mark on that, but there's no question mark on the fact that there will be videos available of the presentations to watch at some point down the line. So everyone can benefit at some point. It just might take a little bit of time.
That's right.
Well, I can't wait to see you there. And congratulations again on what I know is going to be a hugely successful event. So I can give you the congratulations now because it's a given.
You.
But it'll be nice to give them to you in person as well. I wonder if you could wrap up the show for us today that has been absolutely jam-packed with gems of information for people, but perhaps you could leave us with one extra top tip at the end.
A top tip. Well, I think it's thematic from what we've been talking about today that you need to consider yourself to be the one that all the experiments are geared toward. And that doesn't mean that every individual is, you know, not non-human and so special that things aren't going to apply to them. But really, that we all do have individual kinds of situations going on in terms of what we're dealing with, what we're coming into a situation with. And you really have to trust your own instincts, trust your hunger, trust your thirst. Try things on yourself and find out how it makes you feel. And take measurements if you can so that you can report back to the community.
Well, fantastic. Thank you so much for talking to me today, and I look forward to seeing you soon.
I look forward to it too. Thank you for having me.
To get the resources and links from the show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you want to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. If you fancy joining me on this exciting adventure and want to help me create new episodes, please go to my Patreon page at patreon.com/ketowoman or simply hit the support button on the Keto Women podcast website. Please help other people hear about and find this podcast by reviewing the show on my Facebook page and iTunes or whichever podcast app you use. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share and comment on my posts. Your support means the world to me. Thank you. This week's end quote is from Ralph Waldo Emerson. All life is an experiment. The more experiments you make, the better. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.